fields of bodies burning. As the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind. Poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
Hi, this is Bob Petrakis, bringing you the other side of the news.
And I'm Dan Dugan, the other guy on the other side. WGRN, the Green Renaissance.
This is Bob Petrakis, bringing you the other side of the news on WGRN 94.1, the Green Renaissance. And again, we have a Dan Kovalak, whose latest book, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, How the U.S. is Orchestrating a Coup for Oil. Is there anything new here other than the specifics of Venezuela? Hasn't the United States done this before? Didn't we overthrow Chile, the longest-running democracy other than the U.S., if we count the U.S., in the Western Hemisphere back in the 70s?
Yeah, well, you raise a good point. I mean, this isn't new, and we need to know that. We need to know our history to see that the playbook the U.S. is running against Venezuela right now looks a lot like the playbook they ran against Chile in 1973, like they ran against Guatemala in 1954, like they ran against Iran in 1953 to overthrow their democratically elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh. You know, this is the CIA playbook to overthrow a foreign government that the U.S. has decided is not compliant with its economic interests.
And again, as I recall, the Chilean coup, they actually repeated some of the stuff in Panama where the propaganda was so blatant. Red underwear, devil worshiping, same things Allende was blamed for. They blamed Noriega for as well. So this is another great propaganda war, is it not, where they're going after Maduro?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, how this looks like these other coups is that what happens is the U.S. Economically strangles another country. And so in the case of Chile, you know, Nixon famously stated that he was going to make the economy scream, which he did through various measures to undermine the Chilean economy. But then, of course, once he did that, he blamed the Allende government for the economic woes. And that's exactly what we've done to Venezuela. We've been sanctioning Venezuela since 2015. Trump has really upped the sanctions beginning in August of 2017. And since that time, according to very well-respected economist Jeffrey Sachs in a recent report, mm-hmm. over 40,000 Venezuelans have died because of U.S. sanctions. And so part of the game is to destroy the economy, but then to blame the Venezuelan government for the economic woes. And you see this happening invariably in the press. You know, a cousin of mine from Cleveland, right-wing cousin, just emailed me something about Venezuelans looking for food in dumpsters in Venezuela. First of all, there's people, obviously, that we know in this country who look for food in dumpsters in the inner cities of the U.S. But even putting that aside, Venezuela has been cut off from getting food, getting medicine because of these sanctions. And then they use the fact that they don't have food and medicines against them to support regime change. It is a horribly manipulative scheme that's happening there. And again, When was the last time you heard Jeffrey Sachs from Columbia University interviewed about what he found in terms of the sanctions? Or the UN expert, Dr. Alfred de Zayas, who has made the same conclusions, that it's the sanctions that are wrecking the Venezuelan economy.
And if we speak of people like John Perkins and Confessions of an Economic Hitman, I mean, this was a hit by the United States on that economy, what was it not? And we've done this before. Is it safe to say the coup that overthrew Mossadegh was essentially a British petroleum interest-backed coup? Or in Chile, there was the role of Anaconda. Are those things similar here?
Absolutely. So first of all, you mentioned John Perkins, who I cite in my book, because Perkins, in his new edition of The Economic Hitman, he mentions Venezuela, and he mentions his friends who were jackals, as he calls them, who were trying to undermine the Venezuelan economy back in 2002. So this really has been going on for many years. And yes, so where you had oil interests in Iran, and you had, as you mentioned, Anaconda Copper, and you had ITT in Chile.
And United Fruit in Guatemala?
Exactly. Here in Venezuela, you have Exxon Mobil, whose interests were nationalized by Hugo Chavez. You have the Koch brothers, who a lot of people, everyone knows the Koch brothers, mm-hmm. is, you know, some of the biggest donors to right-wing causes, but they also have huge oil interests.
And that's in heavy crude, is it not?
What's that?
And that's in heavy crude, right?
That's in heavy crude, and that's what Venezuela has. And, you know, Venezuela has the largest known oil reserves in the world, and it's mostly in heavy crude, which is exactly what the Koch brothers are interested in. So, and John Bolton, who's the national security advisor for Donald Trump, has been very open about the fact that he's already been in conversations with U.S. oil companies about what interest they will get once the U.S. is successful in overthrowing the current government in Venezuela. You know, this is a barely disguised grab at Venezuela's oil, at its gold. You know, Venezuela has $1.5 billion in gold deposits in England, which now England is refusing, the Bank of England is refusing to turn over to the government there. It has huge coltan reserves. This is nothing but a stick-up. And in fact, in the most recent round of sanctions, Trump has seized $7 billion in assets from Venezuela's U.S. oil company, Citgo. $7 billion. He just took it. And $5 billion of that was earmarked for medicines and food. So this is nothing but an old-time colonial resource grab, and people need to realize that.
And Perkins, and I've made these arguments myself in an article, not that similar to what happened to Gaddafi, 144 tons of gold and equal amounts of silver. And the strangest thing is, while he was being forced out by NATO, which is hardly ever mentioned by the New York Times, they'll say it was the Arab Spring, and they'll never mention the role of NATO. But soon afterwards, the International Monetary Fund, World Bank, was talking about making loans to the richest country in Africa.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think Libya is a great example of another disastrous so-called humanitarian intervention where the U.S. claiming to protect human rights attacked another country, destroyed its economy, turned Libya from the most prosperous country in Africa to the least prosperous one, a country now ruled by competing warlords, a country where Black Africans are now being sold in public markets as slaves. But it was all being done in the interest of the West wanting total control over Libya's rich oil resources.
So in that case, Libya was one of the 10 largest oil producers in the world. And in case of Venezuela, you're saying the leading producer of crude oil in the world. Is that correct?
Well, Venezuela has the largest known reserves in the world. Some of those are untapped. But that's what the U.S. Is after, is all of those reserves. And let's be clear, the U.S. doesn't need oil. The U.S. is now the largest producer of fossil fuels on Earth. It is now exporting fossil fuels. It doesn't need them. This is about control. As Noam Chomsky has always stated, and even in the case of the Middle East, it's not about access to oil. It's about control. And the U.S. wants to control Venezuela's rich oils, rich oil wealth, for geopolitical reasons and also for profit. They want to make sure, the U.S. wants to make sure, it's their companies that are profiting from Venezuelan oil and not the Venezuelan people, which is the, you know, what Chavez and then Maduro have tried to put in place, to use the oil and wealth for the benefit of their own people and, frankly, for the benefit of people throughout the region. People might remember, in fact, that Chavez provided low-cost oil to people in the inner cities in New York City and Boston as well. You know, but that is anathema to those who run our government. They want this wealth used for the interests of private profit.
I'm talking with Dan Kovalik, who will be in town here on May 14th, 7 p.m. at the CWA Local, and that's at 620 East Broad Street. So make sure you come out, listen to what he has to say. He's written numerous books, not just How the U.S. is Orchestrating a Coup for Oil. His new one, entitled The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, but he's also written books regarding the plot to scapegoat Russia, how the CIA and the deep state have conspired to vilify Putin. And again, if you look at U.S. power, that's a fascinating case as well, because they went after him for elections when the U.S., by my standard, and Jimmy Carter in Der Spiegel, when he says, you know, he doesn't observe elections here because they don't meet minimum criteria of democracy. We allow private, partisan, for-profit companies to, in fact, you know, download the source codes, secretly write the source codes on these electronic voting machine, and then we go after Russia. Is this part of the same game the CIA is playing?
Well, absolutely, and Venezuela is even a starker case. You mentioned Jimmy Carter, who said recently that the U.S. does not have a functioning democracy. And what did he say about Venezuela? He said of the 92 countries he observed, Venezuela has the best electoral system in the world. And so you have the U.S. without a functioning democracy, with a president who is president after losing to Hillary Clinton by nearly 3 million votes, trying to overthrow a government in Venezuela with a superior electoral system on the grounds that somehow we can teach Venezuela democracy. It is absurd. It is the height of absurdity.
And you're listening to WGRN 94.1, The Green Renaissance. I'm Bob Fitragus. This is The Other Side of the News. We're talking with Dan Kovalik, labor and human rights lawyer, who will be in town on May 14th, 7 p.m. at the CWA Local, 620 East Broad Street. Hope to see you there. Are these actions by the U.S. illegal? You're a labor and human rights lawyer. It seemed to me that for NATO, set up for defensive purposes in the Cold War to attack a sovereign head of state because jihadists are upset in one region of his country. That seems to be illegal under international law. Is that true?
Well, yes, of course. So under the UN Charter, under Article 2, it is illegal to either use or even threaten force against another country. What one must do, what is the proper thing to do if a country believes that international peace and security is at risk, they must go to the Security Council for authorization, even to impose sanctions against another country. The only time a country can unilaterally use force against another country is if there has been an armed attack against that country. And Venezuela has never attacked us. They've never threatened to attack us. They will never attack us. There is no basis in international law for what the U.S. is doing to Venezuela.
And are they not backing someone who really wasn't running for president?
Yes, so Juan Guaido is the guy the U.S. is backing. When he announced, at the urging of the U.S., by the way, that he was president of Venezuela, a poll was taken in Venezuela which showed 80% of Venezuelans didn't even know who he was. He never ran for president. Never got one vote for president. Meanwhile, Nicolas Maduro has won two elections, both of which, by the way, I observed as an election observer in Venezuela. Juan Guaido has no claim to the presidency of Venezuela, and yet the U.S. claims that it is supporting Juan Guaido for the purposes of cultivating democracy, and nothing could be farther from the truth.
Now, is there a caste system, so to speak, in Venezuela based on skin color, people that are mixed race, indigenous people, and, say, the descendants of the conquistadors from Europe?
Yes. Well, you know, and it's not so dissimilar to the U.S., but, yeah, in Venezuela, you have a system that's been clouded by racism, by a history of slavery, in which indigenous people and Afro-Venezuelans, you know, there are African Venezuelans, have been discriminated against, have been really kept out of the political process and the economic process. Hugo Chavez, who the U.S. has so vilified, who considered himself, by the way, a black person, really set about to formally bring Afro-Venezuelans and indigenous people into Venezuelan society to make them visible. And so one of the first things he did was open a constituent assembly throughout the country in which the people were able to participate in rewriting the Constitution, which then was ratified by referendum of the whole country, and which, among other things, for the first time recognized Afro-Venezuelans, recognized their legal rights, recognized the rights of indigenous people, and the rights of indigenous people to speak their indigenous languages. And he also began to give land back to Afro-Venezuelans and indigenous peoples that had been stolen from them. You know, and this is what the opposition in Venezuela is upset again about. If you look at the different rallies, the opposition rallies versus the rallies of those who support the government, you will see those who oppose the government in these rallies tend to be whiter, more well-to-do people, and those supporting the government are darker-skinned, poorer people, because those are the people who have benefited from the revolution. And the opposition resents the fact that they see their country as being turned over to brown people. I mean, I can't put it in any other terms, and that's the terms they put it in. And they want the country back. And the irony is, in this country, many liberals who would side with people of color are actually siding with the wealthier, whiter, racist part of Venezuela in supporting this coup against Nicolas Maduro.
And again, this is nothing new. Did we not U.S. back a coup and had Hugo Chavez removed and sent off to a small island? And really, it was the people that poured into the streets and into the palace of government to demand his return. So there's, again, precedent for this long train of abuses that we've done there. And that what I found very interesting, and this seems to be part of the propaganda war you look at in your book, is that they claim that Hugo Chavez wasn't legitimate, etc. And then as soon as he was removed, the New York Times starts writing about how popular he was, and he really had populist support. It's the new guy, Maduro, that has no support. But I've seen some of those rallies. You know, they've been on the internet. Just massive amounts of people have poured in to the streets to support Maduro, who's the elected leader.
Absolutely. So let's go back to what you said. It is very true. There's a great movie, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, that people can find on the internet, which documents, you know, Chavez, Hugo Chavez, the duly elected president, being kidnapped in April 2002, taken to a military base for 2 days in a coup that was backed and instigated and supported by the U.S. The first thing the opposition did, and by the way, the same folks we're seeing right now in the opposition were part of that coup. They got rid of the Constitution, disbanded the Supreme Court, disbanded the National Assembly, fired every governor and mayor who had been elected since Chavez had been elected in 1998. And the U.S. recognized this coup government, this very anti-democratic government. But as you know, and as the Revolution Will Not Be Televised documents, people came down from the poor barrios of Caracas to the presidential palace and demanded that Chavez be returned. And he was returned because of their protests. But the U.S. and its compliant media, like the New York Times, for 2 days or 2.5 days said, oh, democracy's been restored by this coup, which in fact had destroyed democracy there. And then, of course, everyone had to backtrack once Chavez was back in power. And as you say, you know, and then once Chavez died, now it's Maduro who is undemocratic, according to the U.S. government and its very compliant media. But again, he has been duly elected twice in what Jimmy Carter has said is the best electoral system in the world.
Yeah, and particularly in contrast to the U.S., that's what's so stunning. We don't even have paper in 40% of our machines in the U.S. You can't even recount. It's push and pray. It's faith-based voting.
Right. And in Venezuela, you have a uniform system throughout the country, which has, one, you cannot even vote until you present your fingerprint and a voter ID. The fingerprint turns the voting machine on. You then cast an electronic ballot. And then once you're done voting, it prints out a paper receipt that you put into a box showing, you know, hopefully that who you voted for electronically was, in fact, the ones you voted for. And then by the end of the night, 54% approximately 54% of all the votes are audited to make sure that the electronic votes meet up with the paper receipts. This is an incredibly elegant system, which does not exist in the United States, and which guarantees a free and fair election, one person, one vote. Of course, we don't have one person, one vote in the United States because of the Electoral College, which, again, has now allowed, in recent years, Donald Trump and George W. Bush to be elected without the popular vote.
Yeah, the loser wins. We're wrapping up here. I'm with labor and human rights lawyer Dan Kovalik, and he's coming to town. His latest book, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, and that he'll be in town May 14th, 7 p.m., CWA Local 4502 at 620 East Broad Street. How can people, do you have a website, a way for the listeners to get a hold of you?
Well, thanks for asking. First of all, you can find my books on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, most independent bookstores, and I also write a lot for Counterpunch, and that's where you can find me.
All right. Thanks for your time, and keep up the good work bringing people the other side of the news, that is the fact-based side. Thanks a lot,
and thank
Dan Kovalik.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to The Other Side of the News. This is Bob Fitrakis.
And Dan Dugan, WGRN 94.1 LPFM, The Green Renaissance.